Hey, I'm Tara Morgan. I live on Vashon Island in Washington, founded Seize the Oar Foundation in 2013, am fanatic about coaching Learn to Row, and I believe the pair is the best boat.
And I'm Rachel Friedman. I live in Washington, D.C., am the owner of RowSource, the founder of the Alliance of Women Rowing Coaches, and I can't row a single in a straight line. Between us, we have nearly 40 years of rowing, coaching, and coxing experience.
Here at Steady State Podcast, we're fascinated by backstories, the real life experiences on and off the water that make people the rowers, coaches, and coxswains they are today. From indoor rowing to flatwater masters to coastal and ocean adventurers, we celebrate you, who represent the global humanity of our sport. Together, we disrupt and expand the narrative about rowing culture.
If you're a first-time listener, welcome. If you're coming back for another episode, thanks for being here.
Thanks to our patrons, whose support makes this podcast possible. Join our team for as little as $5 a month at steadystatenetwork.com/Patreon.
And Live to Row Studios, where rowing is for everybody. Their expert coaches lead live indoor rowing classes and training camps every day of the week. We're currently training in their endurance camp. Get in touch with a coach for your free introductory session at livetorowstudios.com.
We are talking about heart attacks, emergency preparedness around the boathouse and on the water. And this is going to be episode 4 of this series.
Yeah.
What kind of prompted this whole series to begin with?
Well, I have to say, I've had some personal conversations at regattas. You know, those really wonderful interactions that are completely random at regattas. We've all had them. You make some incredible discovery about someone, or they're just all of a sudden so open with you. But I met a couple of people over the last 10 years at regattas who had survived widowmaker heart attacks, like big deal heart attacks. The Ancient Mariners is this team that rose out of the Pocock Rowing Center. And the Ancient Mariners are this very fun, hilarious, but very serious at the same time, group of older male rowers. And they are like captains of industry. They are CEOs. I was working for Pocock Foundation in the development office. And I remember being in the office at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they all came back from their workout on the water. And I remember there being this very heavy feeling. And then someone said to me, they lost a rower. I'm like, what do you mean they lost a rower?
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, there was a rower died on the water, like had a heart attack in the boat and they couldn't save him. This was so moving. They have this security footage and it showed the 8 going out and the 7 coming back. And I knew Damien Winship, who was the coach, and he was, you know, in his late 20s, probably early 30s at the time. He was actually coaching the Mariners as a substitute while their main coach was on maternity leave. Mm-hmm. He had been there a couple of months. And the gentleman in question's name was Richard. He was trying out the Ancient Mariners coming from another team called the Sammamish Rowing Association. And Richard was just trying out the Mariners. And so they didn't have an established relationship with him. And about a year after this happened, I felt like I wanted to hear from Damien as a fellow coach of older adults. I was at the time teaching a class called the Midday Rowers, which was the duck watchers, essentially at 9 o'clock in the morning. But they were between the ages of 60 and 82. And I thought, there's probably some lessons to be learned here. So I sat down with Damien a year after. I wanted to wait a year and just asked him to tell me the story. And it is absolutely moving. And I really enjoyed revisiting it. This was in 2016.
Yeah. So what was going on in your life that you had the presence of mind to actually record this interview with him? Because this is before we started doing Steady State Podcast.
I think I was trying to collect some helpful information for coaching older adults, because I kind of felt like older adults were getting the short end of the stick in terms of they weren't really getting coached very much. They were being overlooked. They were being maybe overworked. You know, there wasn't real collaboration. And I was starting to develop some strategies or philosophy around working with older adults. And I had started a project actually called the Rowing and Aging Project. And this was part of that project where I was trying to establish that rowing is a life sport and how can we keep people in the boats longer? and because they love it so much. And the Ancient Mariners and Damien provided a story that stuck with me for a long time. And that really helped inspire me to tell you about having a series about emergencies and on-water emergencies.
I'm really glad that you got this recording. It sounds like you guys sat down in a coffee shop and talked about what happened that day. And so just for our listeners, we want to give you a heads up. The sound quality is really different than you're used to. There's some background noise we weren't able to get rid of, but get through the first couple of minutes and that background noise disappears and you'll hear a really wonderful interview between Tara and Coach Damien Winship.
It is emotional and we really hope you learn something and get to honor Richard in a way.
Please listen all the way through. At the end, we have Tom Rooks, U.S. Rowing's Director of Safeguarding, who provides us really fantastic on-water tips for emergency situations.
So first, I just ask you a couple of logistical questions. Because part of this is there's a lot of soul to this story. There's a lot of devastating heartbreak to this story for you, for the family, for everybody. There, of course, is there stuff to learn.
Yeah.
And I don't ever want to lose sight of the human side of it.
But there's facts and numbers and
sure.
too. Yeah.
So tell me, when was the last time before that happened, when had you had CPR training?
It was between a year and 2 years.
So it had been a while.
At the point that it happened, I had had CPR certification at 3 different times. So I had it the original time when I was in college, and then 2 separate like re-ups.
Yeah.
And the span in between each of those was no more than 2 years.
Yeah.
But it had been a little while.
Since you thought about it, played it out in your mind.
Yeah.
You know, of course.
Yeah.
We never think anything is going to happen.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So you had maybe a year or two had passed.
Yeah.
I think it's every 2 years that it expires.
Yeah.
How long have you been coaching the Mariners?
At this point that Richard passed, I was on the job about a month. He passed in March, and I had started in early February.
Yeah. Trying the Mariners out.
Yeah. Right? So, I mean, it was maybe his like fifth or sixth practice because, you know, the Mariners go 3 times a week. He had just come over from Sammamish and he was feeling it out. And he also was having back issues as well.
Oh.
I talked to him a lot. He's a great guy. He's just super into rowing. He wanted to have fun and do races and get out and like get a workout in.
Yep.
So the Mariners provided that. So he was coming over for practice.
Yeah. And his girlfriend's son was a junior at Hogback at the time also.
Yep.
You seem like the type of person, just from the little that I know of you, you seem like at go time, you would be good.
Yeah. I think
like a voice of reason.
Yeah. I don't see any reason to get all hysterical and freak out about things because it doesn't help the situation.
And actually, you kind of feel like you go the opposite direction. Like you feel compelled. Tell me about the day. How it went.
So I was out on the water. I had 2 8s. Richard was in one of them. I believe he was 4 seat. And I had a couple small boats too. All the boats were together. We were doing pieces. I believe they're like 7 or 8 minute pieces. So like our last work of the day, we were at Ballard Bridge facing back towards Fremont.
What?
It was going to be a, you know, 7 to 8 minute piece of work taking us most of the way to the Fremont Bridge. And then it was going to be a paddle back to the boat house.
How many 8s did you have again?
2 8s.
Just 2.
Yeah. So the 2 8s were, it was basically like, I can't remember. It was like a single and a double in the 2 8s. And it'd be like single, double, go, send them a minute ahead. And then I'd start with the 8s. So everyone was in view. But that's part of the reason that complicated it was having 4 boats to deal with. It's beginning of March. It's still pitch black. It's like about 6:15 in the morning. So we're going. All of a sudden, the 8s are jockeying back and forth. It was a great piece, you know. Guys are all working hard, seem to be enjoying the work. And then all of a sudden, Richard raised his hand. And it's like, it's one of these moments where it's like, it's dark, so I can't really tell what's going on. I just see 1 8 stops rowing. I see a hand up. I notice that it's Richard. And then I remember our conversation that we had had earlier that week, or maybe the week before, about, you know, hey, my back's really bothering me. I'll let you know. During practice, if it's hurting, I would appreciate it if I could like sit out. So I figured that's what was happening.
Sure.
It's like, he's done. We're doing hard work. He's spent. And so I called out to the crews, you know, hey, what's going on? And the other crew is still going. So at this point, I've got 1 8 that's now a few links ahead of me. I'm with 1 8 that stopped.
How did they stop? Like, if he's in 4 seat, did he just
stopped rowing, so everyone stopped rowing, basically.
They just felt somebody stop.
Yeah. And there was like, tension in the air of like, you know, who stopped? What's going on? You know, so there's this weird moment, 5 or 10 seconds, where no one really knew what was happening. Richard stops, so then his pair partner stops, so then Balfour stops, so then everyone's like sitting there floating. Say we were about 4 or 5 minutes into the piece, so we're getting near SBU dock, just about to enter that Fremont cut area. Yeah. And so right as I'm calling out to the crew, you know, I'm kind of trying to put my stern coach voice in, you know, okay, guys, what's going on? Let's pick it up. Let's battle. Let's figure something out. Let's not just sit here.
You didn't address him directly.
No, I didn't address him directly. You know, kind of the crew, what's going on? You know, all right, Richard and Bill Skilling was his pair partner sitting behind him. It's like, you two sit out. Let's battle back. And right as I'm kind of getting in my head the orders to give them, he slumps over and falls almost out of the boat.
Oh, wow.
And he would have fallen out had Bill sitting behind him not grabbed him. So as I remember it, Richard was 4 seat, Bill Skilling was 3 seat. So Bill Skilling grabs him and pulls him into the boat. And so Richard's kind of in Bill's lap at this point.
He's a big guy.
He's like 6'5"-ish. Wow. And like over 200 pounds for sure.
Yeah, so engine room for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Big, he was a great way, really great way. And a long history with the Canadian national team and all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
He was a crusher. He was good. So I pull the launch over to the aid as quick as I can. My first thoughts are either heart attack or stroke because it was like an instantaneous thing.
Right.
And I'm like, if it's an instantaneous stroke, he's a goner because it means his, you know, blood vessel just blew up in his brain or something. So I'm hoping heart attack. Larry Steele, who's the commodore of the team, was also in this eight. But remember, I was trying to deal with the fact that this guy's laying in the boat. We need to get CPR on him. I need to call 911 and Harbor Patrol and get them here. And I need to try to get this, my other boats, like, to stop.
Probably in order of priority.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So that's the order. Because those guys, and I've had that happen too. And I thought the boat's ahead. Use your brain.
Yeah.
Come back to the coach or go back to the boat.
Well, the other thing is, so Joe Bruner, you know, was in the other eight. And so I'm thinking, I've got an MD 100 feet that way, but he's leaving. And it's like, I want him here right now. But again, priority. So I raft up my launch. So we're rafting the boats together. So Larry Steele, he goes, I know CPR, I'll help. He jumps out of the boat onto my launch and is on my launch giving CPR to Richard in the boat. So that was really helpful having my launch there.
So how, we talked about this the other day, actually. We talked about how hard you have to do CPR and that the deck of the boat couldn't sustain it, plus you're in water.
Well, and it's not even...
And the angle is...
Funny. Yeah, he's not even really on the deck of the boat. He's in Bill's lap, essentially.
Yeah, that's what I sort of imagined, you know, and that your angle's weird and the boat's floating. And, and meanwhile, the crew is freaking out. And
actually, they weren't. They were really hot.
Yeah, they say that's the danger is that the people around the first end won't be able to help you.
Yeah.
Like if you handed your phone to two seat and said, call 911 while I do that,
leap into action.
Yeah.
So what Larry was on my launch giving CPR from my launch onto the aid, which was the most optimal sort of situation we could do.
Yeah.
But again, so Bill is holding Richard's sort of head and shoulders in his lap.
At this point, you'd done your due diligence, decided he potentially was still alive, but he needed CPR.
Without a question, he needed CPR right away. And I remember at the time thinking to myself, like, I'm really glad I had done CPR training so many times because there was this initial, like, couple seconds of freak out. And then it was like, you know what to do. You've been taught what to do. Just, like, chill out. Go through your checklist in your head of what needs to happen and do it as fast as you can. So I actually felt relatively calm.
Well, yeah.
Larry had CPR on him, you know, within seconds of us figuring out what was going on. I called Harbor Patrol and then I called 911. And in retrospect, I had both called and had told both of them what was going on within probably 45 seconds to a minute.
Yeah.
So I don't think in terms of timing, it had an effect on the outcome. But if it happened again, I would call 911 first because they're going to call the fire department and Harbor Patrol and everyone needs to get there. But my thought was like being so close to SPU, Harbor Patrol's right there. They're right there. I want to get them here as quick as possible. To me, that was now a couple minutes have passed. Everyone's been called.
You're in the middle of the canal.
In the middle of the canal. And there's like boats coming by. And, you know, at one point, I believe it was a Holy Names coach was like, are you okay? Do you need help? Like, can I do anything? And it was this moment of, it's like, well, we're just going to stay tight until the paramedics come. There's nothing really we can do.
Right.
And so my thought was kind of like, just get your crews out of here. Like, I don't want anyone else in the way of what's happened. There was no shortage of people like, I can help. Let me help. So that was great. That was a good thing. But there was really nothing else to be done. So then there was this moment of a couple of minutes where it's like, I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what to do. And so I was thinking, it's like, well, if I can get Richard onto my launch, then I can get him to the dock faster than waiting for Harbor Patrol. But then I was thinking, like, this guy is well over 200 pounds. He's completely lifeless and limp. If he's in the water, then he's a goner for sure. Like, I don't know if he's going to sink. I don't know if he's going to fall. Like, I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
So it's like, I'm not going to add that extra variable of risk into the situation. Once I decided that wasn't an option, I told Larry, who'd been doing CPR for a few minutes, and I was like, Larry, I know CPR. Would you like me to take over? And I had to repeat myself a couple of times before he like heard me, because he's
like in the zone.
And then he was like, yeah, please.
What happened with Joe? Did you get that boat back?
No. I gave him one shout right after I had recognized the situation. I gave him like one or two shouts of like, wait enough, stop, come back. And then that was it. I just put him out of my mind.
Yeah.
Because the thought is, I don't want to lose, I don't want them away. I want Joe to be here, but I'm also not going to waste time and energy worrying about them when I've got this guy out there. So yeah, we just sat tight.
Something that the other coaches could have done, though, is gone after your cruise.
Yeah.
And said, go back to the boathouse.
But it's chaotic couple of minutes.
Yeah. It's like two minutes of your life.
Yeah. My priority here is Richard and taking care of him. And I'm not going to stop focusing on that.
To worry
about anything else for the time being.
Yeah.
But then we got to that point where I did have time to just sit. Then I took over CPR. That was probably the most like heartbreaking part, because it was like, he still had a little bit of life in him at that point, where I would give him chest compressions and breaths, and he would like cough and sputter a little bit.
Yeah.
So then I would stop and wait, because if someone like comes to, I'm not going to keep hammering on their chest.
Yeah.
But of course, he would just stop. I would get a couple sputters. I would give it a pause to see what was happening. He'd stop breathing. I would go again. So it was this sort of like, it was this really rough sort of like back and forth.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm giving him CPR. It's sort of working. So I stop. So he stops breathing, and then back and forth. And
having never done it before, like, you don't know.
Yeah.
You kind of, it's like out of the movies. Like, what are you listening for?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All I knew, all I could see was what was right in front of me, and the fact that he's not breathing now. Okay, he's breathing. I'm going to stop what I'm doing. And of course, this is all matters of seconds, right?
Like, sure.
Yeah. Stopping chest compressions for a couple of seconds and then starting again.
Meanwhile, Larry's back in your launch boat, kind of holding on and making sure.
Yeah. And the entire time, everyone, it was really amazing, actually. Like, even though it was a very hard situation, it went like as, I guess you could say, well as it could have possibly gone, in the sense that like everyone was on top of it. Everyone was, Larry had CPR on him so quick. All the other guys around were really calm, and they were just like words of encouragement, like talking to Richard. But they're all saying like, Richard's going to be okay. Stay with, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that the situation itself was, I don't know how we could have done things any better, how it could have gone any quicker. Just a couple minutes later, Harbor Patrol's there. By the time Harbor Patrol gets Richard to the dock, paramedics are there with a DPIM. And they've got it on him, the moment that Richard gets to the dock. But at that point, I think he was gone before Harbor Patrol ever.
Well, that's
got
what
there.
Joe told me the other night. Joe said he was probably gone as soon as he collapsed.
Yeah.
But that there was still some physiology happening.
Yeah.
And he said that was the hardest thing, was that it's like it was so quick.
Yeah. What I understand now after the fact, is that there's atrial fibrillation and ventricle fibrillation.
Oh, VFib and AFib.
Yeah. So AFib is like the heart flutter, quote unquote, where that's the chambers of your heart that pump blood into the other chambers of your heart, which are the ventricles, which then pump it out to your body. So if you get an AFib, your heart can kind of like, it flutters around, but it can figure it out and get back in rhythm. If you have VFib, that's all the blood stops going to your body all at once. So that's why it's usually lethal. Unless you happen to have a defibrillator right there and can get it on them within a matter of seconds.
Yeah.
How
did Harbor Patrol get him out of the eight into their boat?
They just had like four huge dudes on their vessel.
They just stabilized.
And the four guys just came up and muscled him on there. And I mean, they had trouble with it.
they just drag them onto their boat.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what the height difference is between
Dark
Patrol and your show.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't easy. Like, they did it as quickly and as efficiently as they could, but like, they were having trouble with it. And that made me feel good about the fact that I didn't try to do it myself.
Thank God I didn't try that.
It's like, she definitely has seen, you know, these three or four season vets of like, this is their job and they've done this before and they know what to do. And they were struggling with it a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they took him to the SPU dock.
Mm-hmm.
You're still on your launch boat with this gate.
Yeah. And at some point, the other eight gets back and Joe gets with the paramedics, Joe Brenner.
Yeah.
And at this point, like, my sense of time and order of events is all wonky at this point. So I know that Joe was there when they pronounced him dead. And I know that Joe had somehow gotten back. So somehow word had gotten to the other eight. I can't remember if they had gotten to the boathouse and then guys had driven back, or if they had actually rowed the boat back and Joe had gotten off on the dock. Joe would remember that detail. But Joe was with him, and he was the one that came back and gave me the news. Because it was once
you rowed the eight back.
Yeah, once the paramedics got there and, like, Richard was, you know, taken care of as best could with, you know, the professionals, I'm sitting here with this boat, you know, seven dudes in a coxswain who are all shell-shocked. Yeah. And so I just, like, we paddled back to the dock, got there. You know, it was very...
I was there. It was
a surreal experience, yeah.
Yeah, I was there when God came in.
Steady State Podcast is sponsored in part by Breakwater Realty Group. Daydreaming of new lakes, rivers, and coastlines to row and play on? Consider a home in Maine. The Breakwater Realty Group, brokered by eXp Realty, can help you find your home away from home or relocate to a new primary home with ease. Connect with the team by visiting breakwaterrealtygroup.com and scheduling an obligation-free buying consultation. Maine, it's the way life should be. On the last episode, we sat down with Peter Kerman, owner of Burnham Boat Slings, and his wife, Karen Reynolds. Peter has been the face and voice of Burnham since purchasing the business in 1999. When he's not in the shop or out rowing, he's probably manning the Burnham booth at a regatta. That's where we met him, at Head of the Charles in 2022, just a month after he survived a Widowmaker heart attack. Peter and Karen, both successful national team and masters rowers, are a testament to teamwork as they navigated Peter's health emergency and his rehabilitation and return to rowing. If you missed it or any of our episodes, visit our podcast page at steadystatenetwork.com/podcast or wherever you get podcasts. We're back with my conversation with Coach Damian Winship from 2016. That's 1, 2.
And then we just sort of sat around trying to figure out what to do, because it was a really weird situation, as you would remember. We didn't really have any information about the guy because he had just switched clubs. So we didn't have, like, membership information and emergency contact information and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So we contacted his girlfriend first.
Because you knew that relationship. So
yeah.
Kids.
That relationship was understood. Dieter Strusna, who's another member of the Mariners, was one of Richard's good friends. So that was our saving grace, because he was able to give it, like, okay, these are the numbers we should call. This is where he works. You know, this is this and that.
So you guys made those calls.
Yeah. I don't remember doing any of that personally. I think it was Dieter and Joe did a lot of that. Dieter, because he was the friend who knew him, and Joe, because he's the
sort of the official
doctor
type. MD. Yeah, because I talked to Bill when you guys came back, and I think that was actually one of my questions, was knowing the emergency contact information and how that notification happened, or if you left that to the paramedics, or if you left that to the police.
No, so yeah, we did as much as we could on our own from the boathouse, and then I had to go back to SPU afterwards. So Joe was with the paramedics at SPU. He was declared dead. The police got there too. There's a squad car with a couple cops. Like, well, we need to talk to whoever was in charge. And this incident happened. So Joe got a ride back to the boathouse. I got in Joe's car with him. We drove back to SPU. I chatted it up with the cops. The paramedics at that point were gone. You know, they had taken Richard's body to Harborview, I believe.
Yeah. And then you probably had to go through all your protocol with Pohawk.
I did the whole, you know, I did everything, was in good with the police, And then went back to the boathouse. I went and had breakfast with Bill. And just, we just like talked about it. That was crazy. And then I filled out an incident report for the boathouse. You know, I talked to Brianna, I talked to Matt. I remember calling them, you know, as the rowing director and the boathouse manager. I filled out the official incident report. And aside from that was about it. That was all I remember doing day up. I mean, never in a million years did it cross my mind of like, I'm definitely, you know, need to be ultra prepared for if one of these guys kicks the bucket during practice. Like, that wasn't a thought in my mind. And I think that part of the reason why I can rest easy at night after the whole event is the fact that it's like, you know, these guys know that this is a possibility. And I think that the training plan was totally appropriate. Even a lot of the guys even says like, man, that wasn't even that hard of a day, you know?
Yeah.
That was one of our moderate to harder workouts.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't feel like, because that's, of course, where a lot of people's minds go. It's like, what were you having these guys do that suddenly his heart stopped? It's like, well, the work really wasn't that hard.
So you don't coach the Mariners, obviously.
No, I don't. It was pretty tough. So after that incident, I coached him for another month or so. So that happens. Then it really shook me up. And then one of the older guys on the team took a couple months off because he was having heart issues. And then he got a stint put in. And then he came back like 2 or 3 weeks after that happened. That's when I couldn't do it anymore. That's what pushed me over the edge of like, because I found myself at practice instead of like watching the boats and running a practice and coaching and like being a safety launch and this and that, I was just like staring at him the whole time.
Oh,
just like
watching his color. Watching
yeah,
his
exactly.
Body.
Like for any sign of like something going wrong. Yeah. And then I was like, you know, it's like, I am not being a safe and effective coach for this group right now because of my own worries about this single rower.
Right.
You know, Richard had just passed away. So many of these guys are like, you know, that sucked, but man, what a way to go, you know?
Like in the middle of a piece.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Like doing what you love with a bunch of guys you love, you know, a lot of them had this really positive outlook on it, which was great, which helped me manage it. They offered, you know, I didn't end up seeing a therapist afterwards.
Because, I remember they said they'd offered that.
Yeah, but I mean, they put that out in front right away of like, we'll pay for it if you want to go, just let us know. I flirted with the idea. But honestly, after talking through with a lot of these guys, especially Joe was a huge resource. I chatted with him a ton.
He's fantastic.
You know, I reached out to Richard's next of kin and they were totally appreciative of like, you know, we know it's not your fault. Thank you for doing all you could, this and that. I really felt fine with it, you know. I was like, I feel okay. I realized after a while that a big part of the reason why they're part of that group is to help each other come back to reality a bit, because they're all like, and then none of them said this outright, but it was just sort of my observation, but they're all like, you know, waking up every day and they're hurting and their body isn't able to do what they want to do and like they can't fucking take it, they hate it, they're so upset about this. Then they get into a group of guys where it's the same for everyone and they can kind of like help each other manage this transition in their life. Because at a certain point, it's like they can't race.
Right.
But they have this support group around them that's like, okay, well, like, let's go float around in a quad and like keep the round side down. And that'll be the workout for the day.
Well, I can say thank you to you, Tara, for all those years ago having the insight or foresight or interest in talking to Damien. And now we've got this awesome audio interview. It's a peek back at something that happened many years ago, but it's something that can happen any morning on the water. So thank you for making that happen back then.
I have an update. And I think he coached for a little bit longer, but his life took him somewhere else. So.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know if he ever went back to it after all these years, but I can understand what he was saying about just not being able to shake it.
Yeah, he couldn't shake the idea. Like there was a rower in particular that we talk about in the episode where he came back to practice after having a stint put in and was like, I'm fine. And Damon's like, I can't focus because it was too traumatic. I mean, I'll use the word, you know, big T traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
So what I noticed in the talk with him after all these years, even what I noticed was a couple of things that stood out as a coach and as a rower with other Masters adults. First one was they didn't have any emergency contact information for Richard.
Mm-hmm. Who was a new member trying out this club.
So happens all the time. Guest rowers, people coming in and trying it out. A friend is in town. So hot tip, you know, do your due diligence and have them fill out some waiver or some form.
Yeah.
You never know what could happen. The other thing that I thought was interesting was a lot of people asked Damien whether the workout was too hard for the people in that boat. Mm-hmm. And he's like, come on. Like, I know my rowers. I'm not abusing my rowers. People ask, did you cause the heart attack? You know, they sort of.
Right. Which is awful. That. And you should not be blamed as a coach for a workout. Everyone goes to practice knowing that it's going to be whatever kind of day it is. It might be a tough day. It might be an endurance day.
Yeah.
You go to practice knowing that there will be effort.
And it's optional, friends. It's every optional. Practice, you're a master's rower, you're a customer, you're paying for it. It's optional.
And I think this ties in a lot with what we've heard from some of our other guests in this series is that there either was no family history or they had no personal history. They had no reason to be worried that day when they went to practice. And this is the case with most of us, right? We are relatively fit. We're relatively healthy. We go and do the work. It sounds like this was also the case with Richard that day. He'd had some back issues, and that was what his focus was that day.
Right. And one of the first things I asked is I asked him how long ago he'd renewed his CPR certification. Mm-hmm. How often had he had it? Mm-hmm. And he made a really good point that has kept me inspired to just keep doing it. And he said he just kind of went into go mode. The other thing that I took away from this was the ripple effect that this can have on the people in the boat. Because they can't necessarily be helpful to you. I mean, I think about 5C, who was right in front of him. But I thought it was so interesting how Damien prioritized what he needed to do. He called 911. He didn't worry about the other eights. He, you know, if you have multiple boats on the water, that's something that you want to be concerned with. But those are fully grown adults. They're taking themselves back to the boathouse, no problem.
Yeah.
And there's so many people on the water at that point. They look out for each other. The other thing was other clubs' boats being around and offering assistance and him just being very zeroed in. And I think he felt really confident in his skills. But he also, hot tip, knew the strengths and capabilities of the people in his club. Mm-hmm. So you hear him talk about Joe Bruner, and Joe Bruner is a doctor in the club, and how Joe was in the eight that went away and didn't hear him when he asked, when he called out for him. But there was another guy in the boat that said, I know CPR. And so you see how people step up and have different skill sets. I think that's a good inventory to take. Like, hey, what's my crack team here? Like, what's everybody's skills? You know, the con man, the engineer, the magician, the CPR, the doctor. Yes.
I was impressed by how Damien spoke about that day. And I'm sure in the moment there was panic. But he also talked about knowing his checklist and that he checked in with himself and said, oh, right, I know what I'm doing here. I've got my CPR certification and I do yearly training, and that he, in that moment, knew that he could do what he needed to do. I was also surprised to hear he mentioned that the rest of the crew in that eight remained calm. No one was freaking out. And again, that's one of those things you don't know until that happens. And I can imagine everyone just said, oh, whoa, whoa, this is a really serious situation. We need to do what we can to help. And maybe that means just shutting my trap and letting the coaches who are trained do what they can here.
And it sounded like the Mariners did what the Mariners do best, and that is cheer each other on.
Yeah.
And that was the main noise that they were making was, come on, Richard. You got it, Richard.
You got it. You're going to be okay.
Stay with us, Richard. And that's very ancient Mariners. They do that while they row also.
Yeah. So one other thing stood out to me that I think is somewhat controversial, and that I think Damien mentioned that kind of after the fact, Richard had passed away and they're back on the water. And some of the team was saying things like, well, he died doing what he loved. And this is a thing we hear often about rowers or athletes who die doing the sport that they enjoy. And on the one hand, it's this warm, fuzzy thing that we tell ourselves. Well, this was something that they loved doing. It's a great way to go. On the other hand, it's super traumatic. It's traumatic for the team, for the coaches. I mean, I guess it's nice that the team could say that, instead of being like, well, this is the worst day I ever had, they could say Richard went out the way he wanted to go out.
Well, I think that Damien also had a very acute sense that they all were a bit afraid of death and a bit afraid of their bodies breaking down. And that's probably a way that they dealt with it, was just it was a coping mechanism.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot about people dying on the water, doing what they loved. And that's happened a few times. And I just can't imagine the trauma for the people who have to deal with it. Because there's a moment in the story when Damien thinks that he's actually keeping him alive.
Yeah.
And that part just broke my heart because I thought, oh, God, you know, he didn't know what kind of heart attack he was having. He didn't know that he was having a Widowmaker and what physiologically was happening. But
he knew that if he stopped, Richard wasn't breathing.
Yeah. And I have to give a lot of kudos to Damien. He was very willing to do the interview with me. We didn't know where it was going to go. And I got to reach out to him just a couple of weeks ago and find him and say, hey, I don't know if you remember this talk we had back in 2016, but my podcast is Steady State and we're doing this series on heart attacks and heart attacks on the water. And I'm wondering if you'd be okay if we used it. And he said, absolutely. I hope people learn something from it. Absolutely. So kudos to Damien. Thank you so much. Yeah, we hope everybody has enjoyed the episode. And now you'll hear some top tips from Tom Rooks, the U.S. Rowing Director of Safeguarding.
Hi, I'm Tom Rooks, the Director of Safeguarding for the United States Rowing Association. We're discussing a scenario where somebody has a medical event, presumably a heart attack, in an eight while you're coaching. This is a very difficult topic. Even if you've dealt with this before, none of us are prepared and nobody planned in their day to respond to an event like this. I've been a coach for 30 years and also served in the Coast Guard for 22 years. And this has happened to me and it is always something terrifying and you just hope to do your best. The key in this situation is time and keeping them out of the water. Get to assistance as soon as you can of that person. That means the person behind them in a boat, we'll say, for instance, they're in 3C. The person behind them should be holding their head or shoulders to keep them inside the boat. If somebody is first aid CPR qualified, they can turn around, bear crawl over to them, and begin rendering assistance. You might need their help anyway to transport them into your boat. If you can't get them into a safety launch, do so. If you need help to do that, get help. The eight can row back as a six, it'll be okay. The key is getting this person a timely way to help. As soon as it is safe for you to do so, use your cell phone or your VHF radio to call for assistance. While you're taking initial steps to make sure they don't go in the water so they can't drown, have someone else, like your coxswain, call for that assistance and tell them where you are on the river, not where you normally would be at your boathouse. Give them an accurate description of where you are in the situation. The key here is keeping them out of the water. If you get them into your boat, great, get them to shore. If you can't get them into your boat, have that eight head for the nearest safe shoreline where EMS could get to them. This is not ever going to follow a playbook or a script, but the key for you is to do what you can, what you're comfortable with, what you're trained to do, and to do it as quickly as possible to get them to more qualified help. When you're responding to a medical event, presumably a heart attack, you should be wearing the life jacket that you're hopefully wearing just as a coach. If you weren't, get one on before you do any kind of physical assistance rendering. As you approach, pass out life jackets to the crew. People might need to help, and they need to have life jackets so there's no chance they get harmed or drown. When you get on scene, as soon as you can, do whatever you have to do to get a life jacket on that person so should they unfortunately end up in the water, they don't end up under it. Here are a few tips on what you should bring for safety equipment in your coaching launch. First off, have a life jacket for yourself and be wearing it. Second, make sure your kill switch is properly mounted and in use, clipped to you. The next thing is to make sure you have a life jacket for the largest amount of people that you happen to be coaching. If that's an eight, that's nine. If that's a quad, I guess that's four. As many life jackets as you can safely bring. I know sometimes we coach more than one boat. Bring what you can safely keep on your boat to effect a rescue of one of your crews. Beyond that, basic tools for very quick repairs. If it's not a quick repair, that boat needs to go back to the boathouse. Also, make sure you have all the requirements for whatever waterway you're on, be that state, local, or federal. They're pretty easy to find. For a complete list of equipment that is good to have in your launch, please look at the U.S. Rowing Safety Guidelines. Thanks for all you do to make our sport safer. Row safe out there.
To get links to the people, clubs, events, and resources mentioned in this episode, check out the show notes on our website. On the next episode, part 5 of our Heart Attacks and Emergencies While Rowing series, we'll sit down with Willamette Rowing Club rower Bill Bird, who survived a Widowmaker heart attack at a coached practice in his single. Thanks to the quick-thinking coach Plamen Petrov, Bill's life was saved. We'll talk to Bill and his former wife, Jan, who witnessed the events that day, plus hear more safety tips from U.S. Rowing Director of Safeguarding, Tom Rooks. Stay Safe Podcast is supported by RowSource, providing creative design and digital marketing services for clubs, organizations, and regattas. Get the help you need at rowsource.com.
Hey, Tara, I think some listeners might not know that Steady State is more than a podcast.
We should tell them about Friday mornings when we get together for coffee chat. We talk about rowing, racing, technique, and deep dive into things like leadership and inclusion.
So we hope you'll join us Friday mornings at 8 a.m. West, 11 East on Instagram Live. Grab your favorite mug and be a part of the conversation.
Since 2022, Steady State Network has aligned with Allies with Oars to promote inclusion and accessibility for all rowers, regardless of gender identity. We do this by pulling together competitive lineups for major regattas. This year, our amazing team has begun training for Race Around the Rock, an 88K coastal relay race in August around Salt Spring Island in British Columbia, Canada. With your support as an advertiser or patron, we can offer truly equitable access to the event, regardless of financial ability. Show your support at steadystatenetwork.com/allieswithoars.
Ahead in 2024, look for Steady State Network at U.S. Rowing's RowFest in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, July 13th through 20th, and at Head of the Charles in Boston, Massachusetts, October 18th through 20th.
This episode was written, produced, hosted, and edited by me, Tara Morgan.
And me, Rachel Friedman. Tara provides additional audio engineering and is our sponsor coordinator.
Rachel manages our website, social media, and e-newsletter. Our theme music is by Jonas Hipper.
You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Steady State Network. And find Tara at Seize the Oar and Rachel at RowSource. Catch new episodes of Steady State Podcast every other weekend, anywhere you get podcasts.
In two, way enough. That's one, two.